Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. This is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. This week is a very special week for a number of reasons. Sunday is Jerusalem Day, which commemorates the return of the Holy City to Jewish sovereignty for the first time in almost 2,000 years. And I think it's really important for people to stop for a moment and think what this means. The Jewish people started history with a lot of other people too numerous to name: Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, and especially the Jebusites, who were the original inhabitants of Jerusalem. All of them are gone. If you want to know anything about them, you have to go to a museum and see some archaeological remains that are the only thing they left for posterity. And of course, we were around during the Greek period and the Roman period. And as Abba Ibn used to say, we are the only people who live in the same land, speak the same language, worship the same God that we did thousands of years ago. And it's not been an easy period of exile. And in particular, this is an especially exciting time because not only are the streets decorated with Israeli flags, but in the area of Jerusalem known as Arnona, the streets are also decorated with American flags because the American embassy is moving to Jerusalem next week. So America has recognized the old new capital of the Jewish people. So it's really an exciting time, and I'll say a few words about it. And on a different note, there's a big controversy here in Israel about the relationship between the Knesset, Israel's parliament, and the Supreme Court. This is a local controversy, but I think that the listeners should at least know something about it, because it is an issue that affects the rule of law in Israel and the implementation of the will of the people. Although it is a topic which is a bit technical, I'll try to keep it simple because I think the listeners should have an idea of what it's all about and how it affects the future of the country. So, everybody enjoy Jerusalem Day, and next week I hope to report on some of the activities. I'll be back after the break.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire. News, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Don't forget, Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, and again, thanks for listening. This program is being broadcast in the week between Israel Independence Day and Jerusalem Day, the day in which the ancient and only capital of the Jewish people, the capital of the Jewish kings, returned to Jewish hands in 1967, after almost two millennia. The only instance in which a people which speaks the same language, worships the same God, and lives in the same land as it did 2,000 years ago, returned to its capital. Prime Minister Begin used to refer to Jerusalem as Jerusalem, D.C., in the case of Jerusalem, this does not mean District of Columbia, but rather David's capital, D.C. And now, preparations are being made to move the American embassy to Jerusalem 70 years after the establishment of the state. This move is apparently going to occur shortly, with the embassies of several other countries also moving here. Now, I read an article this week which had a comment that made me think about a problem that we have, which I will discuss shortly. But first, I want to read to the listeners a description of the celebration that took place in Jerusalem back in 1968, the first anniversary of the liberation of Jerusalem from the Jordanians who had illegally occupied it from 1948 to 1967. By the way, there are no longer military parades in Jerusalem for a lot of reasons, but the following, which I'm going to read, describes Jerusalem in 1968 when there was a military parade. I'm doing this so that later I will discuss the contrast with Jerusalem Day today and my interpretation of the difference, which first seems subtle, but it's not quite so subtle. So let's go back to 1968, when Jerusalem Day, which is according to its Hebrew date, fell out on the secular date of May 3rd, 1968. And a description, which was written at that time, said the following. I'll comment on it as I read it. Jerusalem had never seen anything like it. This quiet hill city of 240,000 people tripled in size during the day and erupted in a great outpouring of gladness as fireworks over Mount Herzl launched Israel's 20th year of independence. Every fourth Israeli was there. In other words, 25% of the Israeli population came to Jerusalem to celebrate the first Jerusalem Day. It was the first real national celebration since Jerusalem's reunification and the end of the Six-Day War. As for the parade, the show was stolen inadvertently by the Russians. A lone needle-nosed MiG-21 Russian plane streaking across the sky in a long column of modern Soviet equipment, known to the military here as well as most Western countries, only from hearsay and vague descriptions, this drew close attention. Now, keep in mind that the Soviet equipment was taken from the Egyptians during the Six-Day War, and the MiG-21 was brought to Israel 2 years earlier by an Iraqi defector. All the planes in the flyovers were incidentally fully armed, as they always are. According to a senior Air Force officer, many Arabs in East Jerusalem ended up watching the parade, and there was in the main not the grim atmosphere expected after the population had received clandestine orders from Arab leadership throughout the week to ignore the parade and stay at home. Most places of business were closed and the streets were empty. But after the planes flew in formation over the city, first the Arab children brought their mothers out to look, and by the time the foot columns and the tanks began to move, whole families of Arabs were out mingling inconspicuously with the specters in that area of the city known as Wadi Jos. In Tel Aviv, some merrymakers complained they could not find the Carmel Mizrahi wine booths, which the city announced would be selling glasses of wine at rock-bottom prices. There was, however, no lack of little plastic noise-making hammers, which had become familiar at street festivities in recent years. And by the way, you don't see these things anymore. When I came to Israel, they were very common. Even adults seemed uninhibited, hitting complete strangers on the head. In Haifa, the dancers wearing contrasting costumes drew cheers and appreciation as each group demonstrated a dance and style of their own. Fast circling circassians, Gepka dancing Druze, and groups of Yemenite and Hasidic dancers drew special applause. Despite crowds such as Jerusalem had never seen, a delightfully intimate party atmosphere enveloped the city the night before Jerusalem Day. Scores of thousands whirled in dances called horas through the center of the town beneath golden lanterns where Abba Eben and his wife, the foreign minister, were seen strolling along the dancers on King George Avenue, smiling broadly. In the Valley of the Cross, it was nearly 3 a.m. before Shoshana Damari, a popular Israeli singer, sang Jerusalem of Gold to bring the performances there to a close. Dozens of campfires continued to burn until dawn and revealed their smoke hanging over the valley. It was a perfect night for sleeping out, and thousands of out-of-towners simply lay down on the sidewalks after finishing dancing. Some boys swung atop the asbestos canopies covering the benches at the bus stops and stretched out. Jerusalem's parks, the landscaped slope near Jaffa Gate, and the front lawn of the King David Hotel were covered with sleeping people. 60 children were recovered by their parents during the holiday at two lost and found stations, one in each part of the city. So this is the description of Jerusalem Day 50 years ago. That is what Jerusalem Day used to be. Now, I want to say a few words. I want to show the contrast, and that's the reason I read this this particular description to the listeners. Now, I want to say something about what's happening today. Now, I read an article in the Jerusalem Post this week by a woman named Tova Hartman. I don't know who she is, but under the byline, it says that she is a scholar, author, and social entrepreneur. She serves as the Dean of Humanities at Ono Academy College. Now, I don't know who this woman is. It's a very nice, very interesting article about the fact that not all people in Israel respect Remembrance Day. But she starts her article with the following statement. We have just concluded what is commonly referred to as the Israeli High Holidays. Beginning with Passover and extending to Holocaust Remembrance Day for the fall of Israel's wars, and Independence Day, we are enveloped in a bewildering mix of extreme emotions, excitement, solemn reflection, grief, and jubilation, to name only a few. Unquote. Now, this Mrs. Hartman refers to the Israeli High Holiday, begin with Passover, include Holocaust Remembrance Day for the fall of Israel's wars, and it ends on Independence Day. Now, this is a thoughtful and insightful article regarding the Haredi attitude, the attitude of the what they call the strictly religious or the right-wing religious or the other names that are given to people who are very far to the right religiously, about their ultra-Orthodox, as sometimes used, about their attitude toward the state. However, this article contains one glaring error. She writes that what is commonly referred to as Israel High Holidays begins with Passover, ends on Independence Day. Actually, this holiday period continues several more weeks until the 28th day of Iyar in the Hebrew calendar, the day that Jerusalem returned to Jewish sovereignty after two millennia of an often bitter exile. During that exile, Jews turned toward Jerusalem three times a day and prayed, "May our eyes witness your return to Zion," and introduced a prayer after reading with a Psalm 137, which includes the well-known phrase, "If I forget you, Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill." It is this hope and prayer that has sustained our people. The fact that Jerusalem Day today is only commemorated and celebrated by the residents of the city itself and the religious Zionist community manifests a failure of the Israeli educational system. And further, it plays into the hands of our enemies who claim we are intruders and usurpers in a land we stole from others. Therefore, I think it's past time for the Ministry of Education and other responsible agencies of the government to correct this missing element in Israel, in order we should be cognizant of who we are and why we are here. The fact that Jerusalem Day is not a national holiday, but is rather celebrated only in Jerusalem Day, says something about the failure of the Israeli educational system to inculcate full Jewish and Israeli values into our population. I'll probably say more about that on other programs, but I just wanted to make this point. Jerusalem Day is a celebration not only of Israel, but even the Jewish diaspora. Our return to our ancient home is something that should be celebrated all over, not just in the city itself. I'll be back after the break.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
Tamar? She's sassy.
She's smart.
She's funny.
But she's also a real Jewish mother.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tamar Yonah. And yes, I can be all of those things. But at Israel News Talk Radio, I'm here to bring you the news stories and guests that you may not hear anywhere else. Join me live on air Sundays, Mondays, and Tuesdays for the most unique and bold talk radio in Israel.
The Tamar Yonah Show.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
In this section of the program, I want to speak about the struggle that is taking place now in Israel between the Knesset, which is the legislative body, and the court, the Supreme Court of the State of Israel. It's a very bitter struggle, and it has to do with a new law that has been offered in the Knesset. First, let me give the background, and I'll try to keep this as simple as possible. According to the 1947 partition plan for Palestine, an Arab and Jewish state were to be created out of the area of the Palestine mandate that the British had under the League of Nations, then again under the UN. The partition plan was also stipulated that each state, the Jewish state and the Arab state, was to have a written constitution. The Palestinian Arabs and the Arab states rejected the partition plan, and therefore no Arab state was created and no constitution was written. As for the Jewish state, in December 1948, when the state came into being, May 1948, so in December, when the independence war was still being fought, Israel published its draft constitution. However, the Knesset, the parliament, never adopted it into law. In 1950, the Israeli leaders decided the constitution would be legislated what they called chapter by chapter. Thus, in lieu of a constitution, since the state was founded, Israel's parliament, the Knesset, passed a series of basic laws that have become the country's essential constitutional foundation. The basic laws essentially are the constitutional laws of the State of Israel. These laws deal with the formation and role of the principal institutions of the state and with the relations between the state's authorities. They also protect civil rights, although some of these rights were earlier protected as common law by the Supreme Court of Israel. The basic laws essentially are intended to be draft chapters of the future Israeli constitution, postponed since 1950, and they act pretty much as a de facto constitution until their future incorporation into a formal written constitution. As of 2017, functions, according to this uncodified constitution, consists of both constitutional law, based upon cases and precedents, common law, and the provisions of various statutes. The basic laws do not cover all constitutional issues, and there is no deadline set for the completion of the process of merging them into one comprehensive constitution. There is no clear rule determining the precedence of basic laws over regular legislation. In many cases, this issue is left to interpretation by the judicial system. In other words, Israel does not have a constitution. It has a series of basic laws that eventually, hopefully, will be turned into a constitution. So what's happened so far, there's tremendous strength in the hands of the judicial system to interpret the laws. Now, by the way, these basic laws were passed in the Knesset, not by a supermajority. In other words, there are 120 members of the Knesset, and a supermajority would mean you need at least 61 members of Knesset to vote something into a basic law. But these basic laws have been voted by a simple majority of whoever was present. And if you look at the list of these so-called basic laws, they're very interesting. I don't go into the whole thing because I want to discuss the conflict now. But for example, the first basic law established the Knesset. The second basic law of Israel was passed back in 1960. And it's the basis of this law is a special relationship between the people of Israel and the land of Israel and its redemption. For example, the law ensures that the state-owned lands, which constitute about 90% of land in Israel, should remain national property. In other words, they can't be sold off to individuals. They have a third basic law establishing the president of the state. The fourth basic law has to do with the state economy. It lays down the framework for budget laws, rules, taxation, things of that nature. They have a basic law about establishes the military, the constitutional and legal basis for the operation of the Israel Defense Forces. They have, by the way, an interesting basic law that was passed only in 1980, the sixth basic law called Jerusalem, the capital of Israel. The sixth basic law was passed with the intention of the law is to establish the status of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel to secure its integrity and unity and concentrate all the institutions here in Jerusalem. That's very interesting, by the way, that this goes back to 1980. In 1980, Jerusalem was declared the capital by this law, and now here we are in 2018, and the American consulate is finally going, the American embassy is finally going to be moved here. Now, one of the laws that I'll get back to in a few minutes, it's really the most controversial, is judiciary. The seventh basic law dealt with the Israeli judicial system, including judicial authority, the institutions, the principle of independence on matters of judgment, and things of that nature, the powers of the Supreme Court. The eighth basic law had to do with the state controller. The ninth law about freedom of occupation. It's very interesting. It lays down the right of every citizen or inhabitant to engage in any occupation, profession, or trade. Then they have the 10th basic law, human dignity and liberty. That's an interesting one, by the way. It states that human rights are based on recognition of the value of man, the sanctity of life, and the fact that he is free. In other words, this law, his aim is to defend human dignity and liberty in order to establish the values of the state as a Jewish and democratic state. That's sort of a problem in itself, both Jewish and democratic. Anyhow, this law defines human freedom in Israel as being the right to leave and enter the country, to privacy, intimacy, and refrainment from searches of private property and speech, freedom of speech, and things of that nature. Then they have a law has to do with the Knesset also, and the latest law was in March 2014, I think, and it has to do with a referendum. The law requires that if a treaty is proposed for Israel to give up lands, specifically the Golan Heights in East Jerusalem, more than 80 members of Knesset must support the treaty. which is ratified without a referendum. If 61 or more members of Knesset support the treaty, it can be ratified without a referendum, and if fewer than 61 members of Knesset back the treaty, it'll be rejected without the nation voting on it. So I don't want to go into all the details of these things. The point I wanted to make before I get to the discussion about the controversy we're having now is Israel has set up a number of what it calls basic laws, which eventually, hopefully, will be put into a constitution. The reason why many members of the Knesset were against the constitution is primarily because the religious parties say, well, the Torah is our constitution. That's a story unto itself. So here we have a bunch of basic laws waiting to become a constitution. And that is pretty much the background of the legal status, if you will, of the State of Israel. Now, a member of the Knesset, of the party called Bayit Yehudi, the Jewish Home Party, a member of that party has introduced what's called the Override Clause. It's a proposal which states that the Knesset can resurrect laws that were overturned by the Supreme Court by obtaining the votes of 61 members of Knesset, 61 out of 120. This is called a supermajority. Most laws can be passed with a mere simple majority of members of Knesset who can be, or are present in the Knesset for the vote. And by the way, that's how the basic laws were established. Now, there's a push now to reverse the Supreme Court decisions. It came in response to a court ruling earlier this year that stopped the government's plan to deport African migrants to third countries, in part because the agreement with those countries are not being upheld. All the agreements seem to be falling apart. In other words, Israel has a problem of illegals here coming particularly from Africa. The whole area of downtown Tel Aviv is filled with people who have more or less snuck into the country, and the government wanted to pass a law that they would be able to leave them, have them leave for third countries, and the Supreme Court nixed the law. Therefore, the member of Knesset came up with a proposed law that says that the Supreme Court decision can be overturned by a supermajority. And that is the issue which has suddenly come to the fore here in Israel, and there's a lot of bitter controversy about it. If the bill is passed by the Knesset, according to the Supreme Court president, she says if the Supreme Court, if the bill is passed by the Knesset, the Supreme Court will lose its independence and there will be no entity to protect the rights of the weak. That is what the head of the Supreme Court is saying. In the meantime, the Justice Minister says that is not true. The Supreme Court has usurped its power. And I'll get back to this after the break. This has just been a long introduction, and I hope it makes sense. I'll be back.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. In the previous section, I provided sort of a concise description of the so-called basic laws that have been passed over the years by the Knesset. There are 13 such laws. The first was passed in 1958, and the latest in 2014. And since Israel does not have a constitution, these laws are sort of like ladies-in-waiting at a wedding. They are laws in waiting that maybe will someday be part of a constitution. In other words, the constitution is being legislated chapter by chapter. One of the problems is that these basic laws are not voted in by a supermajority, which means 61 of the 120 members of the Knesset. As a matter of fact, some of these basic laws were enacted by the Knesset in the middle of the night without even a majority of the 120 members present. The law dealing with liberty and dignity passed by 32 to 21 votes out of 120, and that dealing with freedom of occupation by 23 to 0. There was no discussion in the Knesset indicating any recognition that a constitution was being adopted. Certainly, there was no understanding that the Supreme Court was to be the final arbiter of what the basic laws meant. But yet, that is how the court has chosen to read them. Now, to understand this, you have to realize it wouldn't be a big issue, but the problem is that the Supreme Court has given itself powers that make it superior to the other branches of the government. Let me explain this a little bit further. In the United States, there are three branches of government: executive, legislative, and judicial. One of the ways that enables proper balance between these branches is the manner in which each branch is chosen. The executive, that is the president, is elected at intervals. The same thing, Congress, the House every 2 years and the Senate every 6 years. Now, the manner in which the members of the judicial branch are chosen is based on the other two branches. For example, the president, that is the executive branch, chooses a nominee for the court, but the nominee must be approved by the Senate, the legislative branch. So there is a certain element of balance. In Israel, unfortunately, it's quite different. The members of the court are chosen by a committee. The committee consists of 9 members, of whom 3 are already members of the court. They are judges, sitting judges. In order to be selected for the court, a nominee must get 7 of the 9 members of the selection committee. But in the history of the state of Israel, there has never been even one instance in which the 3 judges on a committee did not vote as a block. So they only have to get 4 of the remaining 6 to vote with them. In this way, it essentially means that the judges consistently are able to choose new judges who would agree with their approach to the law. Now, the problem is that since Aharon Barak became president of the Supreme Court, he's seen to it that all new judges agree with his activism. Let me give you some quotes. He says that the moment that a certain realm is not justiciable, the wielder of power does whatever he wants. The judge must sometimes depart the confines of his legal system and channel into a fundamental value not yet found in the legal system. The world is filled with law. In other words, Justice Barak says judges can do pretty much what they want. As a matter of fact, Robert Bork, who was once a candidate for the U.S. Supreme Court, wrote that, and I quote, "Pride of place in the international judicial deformation of democratic government goes to the state of Israel. The Israeli Supreme Court is making itself the dominant institution in a nation, an authority no other court in the world has achieved. Imagine, if you can, a Supreme Court has gained the power to choose its own members, wrested control of the Attorney General from the executive branch, set aside legislation and executive action when there were no disagreements about policy. The court has altered the meaning of enacted law, forbidden government action at certain times, ordered government action at other times, and claims and exercise the authority to override national defense measures, which is doing now. Imagine as well a Supreme Court that has created a body of constitutional law despite the absence of an actual constitution. No act of imagination is required. The Israel Supreme Court has done them all." Now, it wasn't always so. Though Israel is a highly politicized nation, the Supreme Court, in order to establish legitimacy, once wrote opinions that were characterized by highly formalistic legal style, narrow interpretation of statutes and precedents, and deference to decision of the political branches of the government, the Knesset and the government. Gradually, however, the Israeli court began to assert its authority to interpret statutes according to what it called the principles of natural justice, which is an amorphous concept designed to cut the court loose from the restraint of law. But this is too obvious. Searching for something that could be designated a mandate for overriding judicial power, the Supreme Court began to claim that its supremacy has been legitimated in 1992 by the passage of two laws, the Basic Law of Freedom of Occupation and the Basic Law of Human Dignity and Liberty. Now, these laws, as I said, were passed by a minority of the members of the Knesset. As I said, the law dealing with liberty and dignity passed by 32-21, and that dealing with freedom of occupation by 23-0. There was no real discussion. So the government has judicial system, the courts, have become the overriding power in the Israeli government. In other words, there's no balance. There's no balance between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial powers. Now, this all came about that by Aharon Barak. He began his tenure in the Supreme Court in 1978. He became the president in 1995, and he's been the dominant figure and increasingly a major force in shaping the nation's policies. So he is already retired, but there's no real opposition within the court itself for the simple reason that, as I said, this block of justices, 3 out of 9 in the selection committee, actually choose people who agree with their kind of activism. And that is a really difficult problem. And that is the thing which is causing the controversy now, that the Knesset wants to pass an override clause in which they say, as I mentioned previously, but it pays to repeat this, that the Knesset can resurrect laws that were overturned by the Supreme Court by obtaining the votes of 61 out of 120 members in the Knesset. This is called a supermajority. Most laws can be passed with a mere simple majority who are present in the Knesset for the vote. Now, the current push to reverse the Supreme Court decisions, as I mentioned before, and it pays to repeat it, came in response to a court ruling earlier this year that stopped the government's plan to deport African migrants to third countries, in part because the agreements with those countries was not being upheld. Now, all these agreements eventually fell apart. So now what you have now is a struggle between the legislative branch, the Knesset, and the judicial branch. And the judicial branch is extremely upset by this. There's been a lot of name-calling, and all these struggles appear in the paper every day. And the problem, one of the problems is, I think, that somehow people think that once you become a judge, you're somehow above everything. The moment you put on the judicial gown, you suddenly become nearer to God than the members of the legislative branch. A very serious problem. So here we are at a really crucial moment in the history of Israel. I'm recording this program on Wednesday. The program is going to go in the air tomorrow on Thursday. And today the news said that the American president decided to pull out of the agreement, the nuclear agreement with Iran. Iran has a tremendous influence on what's happening in Syria. And the world seems to be going up in flames around us. And here in Israel, a lot of our minds are being preoccupied by this struggle between the legislative branch and the judicial branch, which has for the last 30 years taken unto itself powers that make it essentially supreme. They cancel laws and they touch upon items which include defense measures. If you go into the southern part of Tel Aviv today, it's like a foreign country because of all the illegal migrants who live there. And the government, Supreme Court is preventing the government from doing anything about it. So here we have on our borders, we have external problems, and inside the country, we have domestic problems, which is true of any country, but somehow they seem to be exacerbated and exaggerated here in Israel. But I want the listeners just know that here on the domestic scene, the big struggle right now is to control the activities of the Supreme Court, which over the last 30 years has pretty much stuck its nose into a lot of things that have nothing to do with the law. Having said that, I wish you all a good week, and of course, happy Jerusalem Day. And until next time, take care of yourself.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio. Straight talk from Israel.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.